For this March 30th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. It is day two in the trial of Derek Chauvin, and at times witnesses becoming emotional as they recounted what happened in May of last year, resulting in the death of George Floyd. The U.S. has crossed the grim milestone of 550,000 deaths from COVID, and now public health officials are pleading with the public to maintain safety protocols as cases once again begin to rise. Meanwhile, a joint report from the World Health Organization and Chinese scientists found that it's extremely unlikely that the virus leaked from a lab, but its conclusions have been called into question by the Biden administration and a number of other countries, and the WHO director general saying China has withheld data from the organization's investigators. And Canada has paused the use of AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine for people under 55. There have been rare cases of blood clots in some of the recipients. That is now being investigated. And President Biden signing the Paycheck Protection Program, extending that program. The story's shaping Washington Today, ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Minneapolis and inside the courtroom where more witnesses took the stand in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, some breaking down in tears, recounting their memory of the day George Floyd died. The witnesses included a mixed martial arts fighter, that teenager who recorded what is now the viral video of George Floyd's death, and the teen's 9-year-old cousin, as well as two high school seniors who were out shopping. Two other witnesses, a 911 dispatcher and a cashier working across the street, testified yesterday. And lawyers for the defense and prosecution opened the trial by laying out their case. Now, Donald Williams told the court yesterday that he was on his way to Cup Foods, where George Floyd was arrested, when he encountered Floyd pleading for his life. Williams yesterday telling the court that he asked officers to stop the blood choke. He was called back for a second day of testimony today, and he recounted his 911 call.
May 25, 2020.
911,
what's the address of the emergency?
Officer 987 killed a citizen in front of a Chicago store. He just pretty much just killed this guy that wasn't resisting arrest. He had his knee on the dude's neck the whole time, Officer 987. The man went, stopped breathing. He wasn't resisting arrest or nothing. He was already in handcuffs. They pretty much just killed the dude. I don't even know if he's dead for sure, but he was not responsive when the ambulance just came and got him. And the officer that was just out here left, the one that actually just murdered the kid in front of everybody on 36, 38th in Chicago.
Okay. Would you like to speak with the sergeant?
Yeah, like that was bogus what they just did to this man. He was unresponsive. He wasn't resisting arrest or any of it.
Okay, let me get you over to the desk. You can request to speak with the sergeant, okay?
Yeah, and I'm sitting here talking to with another off-duty firefighter that just stayed here watching in front of us as well.
Okay.
And she told him to check the man's pulse, but they wouldn't even check the pulse.
Okay, 1 second.
I have reached the city of Minneapolis to reach someone in our property crimes division.
Y'all murderers, bro. Y'all murderers, Kyle. You gonna kill yourself. I already know it. Two more years, you gonna shoot yourself. Murderers, bro. Y'all niggas is murderers, bro. Minneapolis Third Precinct.
Yeah, he wants to speak with the supervisor relating to 320's call. Cup Foods.
Just one of the 911 calls that was on display today inside that Minneapolis courtroom. Now, in a cross-examination by the lead defense attorney, Eric Nelson, he questioned Donald Williams. That's his voice you heard just a moment ago on that 911 call. Donald Williams did acknowledge that he did not know that the officers had been dealing with George Floyd for 15 minutes before he arrived at the scene outside of Cup Foods. He also conceded that he did not know that an ambulance had been summoned to the scene 3 minutes before he arrived. Here is how that moment unfolded inside the courtroom.
You called him a tough guy.
I did.
You called him a real man.
I did.
You called him such a man.
I did.
You called him bogus.
I did.
You called him a bum at least 13 times.
That's what you counted in the video?
That's what I counted.
And that's what you got, 13.
And that was early on, right? Those terms grew more and more angry. Would you agree with that?
they grew more and more pleading for life.
All right. After you called him a bum 13 times, you called him a bum.
That's what you heard?
Did you say that?
Is that what you heard?
I'm asking you, sir.
I'm pretty sure
you say that?
You heard that. I'm pretty sure you did.
You call him a...
If that's what you heard, I'm sure that's what
I did. I'm asking you, did you say that?
If that's what the video recalled, that's what I did.
You called him a bit.
If that's the video you heard from the video,
it's a yes or no, sir.
If that's what was heard in the video, yes, I did.
And at one point, you said that Officer Tao pushed you.
That's correct. He put his hand in my chest, is what I said.
And you observed Officer Tao push someone else, right? Or feel like he pushed someone else?
I didn't let him touch anyone else.
Do you recall saying, I dare you to touch me like that. I swear I'll slap the f*** of both of you.
Yeah, I did. I meant it.
Right. So again, sir, it's fair to say that you grew angrier and angrier.
No, I grew professional and professional. I stayed in my body. You can't pay me out to be angry.
From day two of the trial in Minneapolis, and this is the headline at New Republic, Derek Chauvin's defense puts Black Lives Matter on trial. Joining us on the phone with more on that story is Melissa Giera Grant. She is covering the case for New Republic. First of all, today's back and forth and the witnesses, what has stood out in your mind?
Just in the opening statements, it seems like both the prosecution and the defense, while they can't technically invoke the uprisings of last summer that made George Floyd's name famous and brought so much more attention and pressure to this case, there is a way that I feel like that conversation is playing out in the courtroom. With the state, we have the use of the bystander video, which I'm sure many people have seen by now, and putting on the stand actually some of the people who shot those videos, and that you can hear in those videos yelling out to the officers to take, to let George Floyd go, to take their knee off his neck, to let them even check his pulse. And on the other side, with the defense, who is largely arguing that Officer Chauvin did as he was trained to do, one of the points they made that's flown a little bit under the radar is that they claim that the bystanders themselves were a threat to the police. And in a way, I think it's kind of indicting. You know, the same police who held George Floyd to the ground for many, many minutes when he was clearly already prone and not moving, of course they would think bystanders shooting a video capturing this would be a threat. Those, you know, again, the defense can't quite come out and say those bystanders are like the activists last summer. But I think invoking that in the courtroom, casting them as a threat, gets to the same thing.
So that goes back to your headline, how this is putting Black Lives Matter on trial.
It's kind of the elephant in the room, right? I mean, a courtroom like this, a case like this, is not designed to actually talk about what mattered to people about this incident, not just getting justice in this one particular case, but also what it means for us to have police officers who are essentially allowed legally to murder people in the course of their job, that it isn't considered murder, that they are very rarely charged with murder when they kill people on the job. That's really the thing that this is about. And now we just have to sort of argue that through this like very narrow lens of was Chauvin doing his job or not? Did he have intent or not? And I think that's why these trials sometimes feel unsatisfying to activists, right? Because you don't actually get to talk about the broader issues. You know, even if you do get an indictment, even if you do get a conviction, it doesn't necessarily change the system that got us in that courtroom in the first place.
And, of course, a lot of testimony in the next few weeks. After 2 days of testimony, what are your own general observations? And you answered part of this a moment ago, but what has stood out?
I think having the bystanders themselves, some of them who were teenagers when they were shooting these videos, having them on the stand, letting the jury hear directly from them, I think it makes it very clear the kind of casualness and the violence that they captured. You know, they were described by the state as, you know, just bystanders who were going about their day and saw something that unsettled them. The very first person that we heard from was actually a 911 dispatcher who same way, very disturbed by what she saw, even though she's on her job as a 911 dispatcher. And she said at one point when she was watching the screen, because she could see what was going on the street on the screen, she thought that the image was frozen because the man on the ground hadn't moved. And she, as the prosecution put it, called the cops on the cops to intervene in what she saw. I thought it was very powerful.
The story at newrepublic.com. Melissa Giera Grant, staff writer, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And there was another moment late this afternoon inside that courtroom. Minneapolis firefighter Genevieve Hansen recounting what she saw that Memorial Day afternoon.
Draw your attention to May 25th of 2020. So at that point, you had been working as a firefighter for a little over a year?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, yes?
Yes, sir.
And were you in the area of Cup Foods at 38th and Chicago?
Yes, sir.
And were you working that day?
No.
And, you know, without telling us where you live, do you live in that area?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm in walking distance of that area.
Okay. And so on that date, in the early evening, just what were you out doing that you found yourself in that area?
I was just going for a walk. I believe I worked the day before. So a lot of times you're just kind of tired, and I just wanted to sort of have a peaceful day. So I went on a walk, and I sat in a little community garden on 38th for a while. Thought it would be getting kind of dark soon, so I decided to take Chicago home rather than go through neighborhood streets.
Do you remember, were you on foot or in your car?
I was on foot.
And so you approached Cup Foods on Chicago?
Yes, okay. Sir.
And as you were approaching that area, did something catch your attention?
Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to see, you know, lights and think that, oh, my coworkers are there. So from a distance, I figured, you know, it could have been anything. But I figured that fire was there, so I started walking in that direction. And as I got closer, there was a woman across the street screaming that they were killing him. So that's when I was alerted that the situation wasn't a basic medical call.
So at some point, did you walk to the area where this woman was?
Yes. I actually asked her what was going on.
And then from there, did you notice some police cars in the area?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes, sir.
And did you then walk over to that area where the police cars were?
I walked.
The police car.
Yeah, I walked kind of in a big circle around the scene just to sort of start to have an idea what was actually going on.
And so you approached this police car where the incident was taking place?
I came from behind the officers.
Just some of the testimony, that from Genevieve Hansen, a Minneapolis firefighter. Her testimony in the trial of Derek Chauvin. By the way, we are carrying it live on the C-SPAN networks. It's available on the web, online anytime at cspan.org. In other news on this Tuesday, as President Biden prepares to travel to Pittsburgh to reveal his infrastructure package, that will come tomorrow, questions remain on how to pay for what is expected to be close to $3 trillion. The plan will include budget offsets, but the White House has not yet said what those offsets will be, and the administration is looking at higher taxes for wealthier Americans and corporations rather than increasing user fees and gas taxes. We, of course, will cover the president's remarks tomorrow here on C-SPAN. Meanwhile, in a joint appearance, the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, joined by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, announcing the state has finalized agreements with Amtrak, CSX, and the Virginia Railway Express, launching what is a $3.7 billion investment. It will expand and improve passenger, commuter, and freight rail in the state, as well as create connections in America's national rail networks between the Northeast and the Southeast corridors. The Transportation Secretary making his remarks in Alexandria, Virginia.
We learned that last week in a rural community of Levelland, Texas, Spartan, which is their local public transit agency, retrofitted their brand new transit facility to be the community's first mass vaccination site. And in a single day, that vaccine clinic vaccinated nearly 1,000 people. In Jacksonville, Florida, the Transportation Authority there helped to launch Wellness on Wheels, a mobile vaccine service ensuring that seniors and underserved communities had the opportunity to secure those critically needed vaccinations. And these are the kinds of efforts that are going to get more support thanks to the American Rescue Plan. It also includes dedicated funds to help rural transit agencies, transit service for the elderly and individuals with disabilities, and transit on tribal lands. So, with the American Rescue Plan, help is here, and that's just the first step. The project we're celebrating today will help people across the region, and the work we're doing collectively will help people across the country. So we're going to continue to look to see success stories like this in communities large and small across the country if we seize the moment that's upon us, a once-in-a-century alignment of demonstrated need, bipartisan interest, public impatience, and I can tell you, a very supportive president leading the way. And we can't wait to work with our partners in states and communities and, of course, in the Senate and the United States Congress to get this done.
One of those partners today, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, that from the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. In the announcement, which took place, by the way, at Alexandria's Amtrak Virginia Railway Express Station, outlining details on what the president and the Transportation Secretary is calling the American Rescue Plan. It also includes about $1.5 billion to get those furloughed Amtrak employees back to work. More on what this will mean for Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam.
This project establishes a pathway to separate passenger and freight operations, which will help both run more smoothly and efficiently. And it creates a vital link in our national rail network by connecting the Northeast and Southeast corridors. Now, America, as you all know, is still in many ways a nation of drivers. We tend to like our cars. But all of those cars on the road come with a price. Every year in Virginia, vehicle travelers experience 230 million hours of delays. I'll repeat that, 230 million hours of delays, resulting in $6.5 billion in annual congestion costs. But adding more highway lanes isn't the answer. A study of I-95 found that adding just one lane in each direction for 50 miles would cost $12.5 billion. It would also take 10 years. And by the time it was done, the corridor would be just as congested as when we started. So we needed a different solution. Rail can add that additional capacity at a third of the cost.
Earlier today in Northern Virginia with Governor Ralph Northam, and this is a headline from the WashingtonPost.com, quote, Virginia seals the deal for a $3.7 billion rail plan, including a new Potomac River Bridge for rail travel. And at the White House today, Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about tomorrow's rollout of the president's infrastructure plan. Here's that exchange.
Thanks, Jen. Question about your infrastructure proposal being released tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Is it going to focus more on shovel-ready projects that could get underway right away, or is it focused more on projects that might take a couple of years to get started but could ultimately have a bigger impact?
It's a great question, and I expect we'll have more to outline on how quickly things can happen once he delivers the speech tomorrow. But let me just say that the speech tomorrow is about making an investment in America. Not just modernizing our roads, our railways, our bridges, but building an infrastructure of the future. So some of it is certainly infrastructure shovel-ready projects. Some of it is how do we expand broadband access? Some of it is ensuring that we are addressing the needs in people's homes and communities. So there are a range of components that will be he'll talk about when he proposes his ideas tomorrow when he lays that out in his speech in Pittsburgh.
And how much more should wealthy Americans expect to pay? Will the top marginal rate go back to 39.6% under this proposal?
Well, I expect that tomorrow, again, the speech is really about his vision for creating jobs, good-paying union jobs and really investing in the industries of the future. But he thinks it's responsible. It's the responsible thing to do to propose a way to pay for that over time. So, and he also believes that there's more that can be done to make the corporate tax code fair. And so I expect that will be the focus of his remarks on taxes tomorrow.
Jen Psaki is the White House press secretary, and on CNBC, Montana's Republican Senator Steve Daines, on the issue of taxes, explained why he is opposed to any rise in corporate taxes as a way to pay for the president's infrastructure plan. Here's what he said.
Raising taxes is generally not a real popular issue for the American people. You look back in 2017, we worked hard to cut taxes and unleash the economy. My colleagues across the aisle, the Democrats, they've most recently now unleashed big government with this massive spending and now proposed tax hikes. Now, the bottom line is tax policy is a means to an end. Cutting taxes helps us become more globally competitive. It creates incentives to reinvest capital and grow businesses, create jobs, increase wages. The bottom line is Republicans want to drive more tax cuts. Workers win with that.
The full interview with Senator Steve Daines is available at CNBC.com. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing nearly 105 points. The Nasdaq was off by 14 and the S&P down 12.5. At Politico.com, congressional reporter Kyle Cheney writing the following quote, "Americans outraged by the storming of Capitol Hill are in for a jarring reality check. Many of those who invaded the halls of Congress on January 6th are likely to get little or no jail time." For more on that story, we talked to Kyle Cheney late today.
So we've been looking at the entirety of the cases stemming to the January 6th riot at the Capitol, and what we've seen is this wide array of charges. But the ones that get the most attention are the ones like the conspiracy charges against militia groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and the police assault charges that are really brutal and often well documented. But what gets less attention is the scores and scores of cases that are much lower level. They're people who essentially walked into the Capitol and walked out, didn't cause any damage, didn't attack anybody. And those cases, as we're finding, are probably going to end up going to plea deals and resulting in little to no jail time, which stands in stark contrast to the way this entire episode has been presented by prosecutors, and going to be kind of jarring for a lot of people.
So far, how many have been publicly charged?
We're over 300, and that number is growing. So we are operating in a little bit of an environment where things are changing. But, you know, we don't, you know, we think it's around 800 or so that went into the Capitol. It's an estimate, and we don't know exactly how many will end up charged out of that larger group.
But it sounds as if, based on what you're saying, the vast majority will be viewed as misdemeanors, if that.
I don't know if it'll end up being the majority. I think the majority will end up being cases that result in plea deals and, you know, maybe no jail type sentences. You know, we've seen maybe a quarter so far of the cases are listed as misdemeanors. Another chunk have not been formally charged at all yet, so we don't know if they'll end up with misdemeanor or felony charges. But there seems to be a pretty standard set of charges for people who just kind of walked into the building and didn't do anything else once they were inside.
In the piece, you write the following quote, "The cases could embarrass the Biden administration, which has portrayed the January 6th siege as a dire threat to democracy." Explain that sentence.
So I think the thing there is more about a messaging issue, which is that, you know, look, Attorney General Garland said this is his top priority, and he and President Biden have described what happened on January 6th, rightfully in certain respects, as an insurrection that was a threat to the, you know, existential threat to the republic. And I think certain elements of that are correct with some groups of people who breached the building, but that broad brush does not, you know, characterize a lot of the charges prosecutors are bringing, again, against these sort of lower level defendants who, you know, just sort of glommed on to the mob or walked in behind the more violent actors. And so the broad brush kind of obscured the much more complex situation that was going on in the building.
The headline, "Many Capitol rioters unlikely to serve jail time," at Politico.com. The reporting of Kyle Cheney. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome back to Washington Today. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your COVID-19 headlines. The CDC is again warning that some regions of the country may already be in a fourth wave, with new cases increasing by roughly 12% nationwide just in the last week. One example is Michigan, which has seen a 122% spike in new cases over the last 14 days. In California, Universal Studios Hollywood announcing plans to reopen on April 16th. That is more than a year after it closed because of the pandemic. But for the moment, tickets will be limited only to California residents. And President Biden calling on governors who have lifted the mandates for masks to reinstate them and asking businesses across the country to require masks as well. On Fox News last night, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham talking about his recent trip to the U.S. southern border. He was there late last week with a number of senators and criticized the Biden administration for what he is calling, quote, a massive system failure in handling the border crisis. Here is part of that conversation with Fox News host Sean Hannity.
I've never seen so many incentives for illegal immigration as I see today. If you're 16 and younger, we're going to make sure you never leave the country. If you have a family member here illegally, we're going to pay to reunite the family illegally. That incentivizes more illegal immigration. Nobody stays in Mexico anymore. You claim asylum in the United States, within about 2 weeks, you're released into the United States without a court date. By the summer, we're going to have 150,000 plus a month. If they don't change policy, nothing's going to change. It's only going to get worse.
That's from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News last night. Meanwhile, as the San Diego Convention Center becomes a temporary home for hundreds of teenage migrants who have crossed the southwest border, a number of San Diego organizations working to provide them with an education during their temporary stay. For example, by last night alone, close to 700 girls between the ages of 13 to 17 from several Latin American countries housed inside the convention center. More than a dozen area teachers already have volunteered to work with those students. And today's White House briefing questions to Press Secretary Jen Psaki about the San Diego facility.
The San Diego County Supervisor, Jim Desmond, he says, you know, I think it's great that there's in-person learning for unaccompanied minors from Central America, but I wish every child in San Diego County was allowed the same opportunity for in-person teaching. So I guess the question is, you know, does the White House think that this sends the right message to these 130,000 kids in San Diego and their parents who've been stuck at home for the last year?
Well, I'm just saying that context is important, and these kids are going back to school for hybrid learning. We, of course, want that to be 5 days a week, and we're confident we'll get there early next month. And I believe they're also on spring break right now. So these teachers would be, I'm not sure if it's volunteer or paid, you'd have to ask the local school district while the kids are on spring break, which I think the context is pretty important.
We carry the White House briefings on the C-SPAN networks, and that earlier today from the Brady Briefing Room with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. In what the Associated Press is describing as, quote, a sharp rebuke of Trump-era policies, the Secretary of State Tony Blinken today formally scrapping a blueprint that was championed by his predecessor to limit U.S. promotion of human rights abroad to causes favored by conservatives, causes like religious freedom and property matters. Well, Secretary Blinken saying that the report prepared by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has sought to pare down the number of freedoms prioritized in the U.S. foreign policy. He called it, quote, unbalanced, saying it did not reflect the Biden administration's policies and would not guide them. Now, the report from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's Commission on Unalienable Rights has been harshly criticized by human rights groups and Democrats. And so with that background, more from the State Department today with the Secretary of State.
President Biden is committed to putting human rights back at the center of American foreign policy. And that's a commitment that I and the entire Department of State take very seriously. We will bring to bear all the tools of our diplomacy to defend human rights and hold accountable perpetrators of abuse. The reports we're releasing today are just one way to do that. One of the core principles of human rights is that they are universal. All people are entitled to these rights, no matter where they're born, what they believe, whom they love, or any other characteristic. Human rights are also co-equal. There is no hierarchy that makes some rights more important than others. Past unbalanced statements that suggest such a hierarchy, including those offered by a recently disbanded State Department Advisory Committee, do not represent a guiding document for this administration. At my confirmation hearing, I promised that the Biden-Harris administration would repudiate those unbalanced views. We do so decisively today. Human rights are also interdependent. If you can't assemble peacefully, how can you organize a union or an opposition party or exercise your freedom of religion or belief? If you're denied equal access to a job or an education because of the color of your skin or your gender identity, how can you attain health and well-being for yourself and your family? The report we're releasing today shows that the trend lines on human rights continue to move in the wrong direction. We see evidence that in every region of the world, this is happening.
Today's release of the annual Human Rights Report and the statement by Secretary of State Tony Blinken. Well, comments yesterday by the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell continued to get a lot of attention today while he was in Kentucky. He urged his fellow Republican men to get vaccinated. That after reports showing that a large percentage of Republican men saying that they did not have plans to receive the vaccine, this is what he had to say.
I can stand here as a Republican man. As soon as it was my turn, I took the vaccine. I would encourage all Republican men to do that. But one of the things I learned in a meeting we just had is there's another segment of our population with some reluctance, and I don't know whether we want to address that or not, but there are some other segments that have some reservations. But with regard to Republican men, take the vaccination. Two of them are 90% effective. One of them is 70% effective. And I didn't realize until this pandemic began that the flu shot is only 50% effective, and a whole lot of people get the flu shot. So there's no good argument.
That from Senator Mitch McConnell. By the way, he received the Pfizer vaccine on December the 18th, and he was responding to the release of a PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll. That survey found that 49% of Republican men would not receive the vaccine. Well, the United States has signed a joint statement with 13 other nations criticizing the World Health Organization and its long-anticipated report on the origins of COVID-19 in Wuhan, China. In a joint statement, the governments of Australia, Canada, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Israel, Japan, Latvia, Lithuania, Norway, South Korea, Slovenia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., wrote that the report was, quote, significantly delayed and lacked access to complete original data and samples. More questions in terms of how coronavirus spread from Wuhan, China, across the world. At today's White House press briefing, this from Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Does President Biden believe that the millions of Americans who lost loved ones to COVID-19 deserve a better response than one that they've gotten from the WHO?
In terms of looking
into the origins for COVID-19?
Well, I think he believes that the American people, the global community, the medical experts, the doctors, all of the people who have been working to save lives, the families who have lost loved ones, all deserve greater transparency. They deserve better information. They deserve steps that are taken by the global community to provide that. So there was an extensive statement put out by a number of countries, including the U.S., but let me highlight, we're still reviewing the report, but let me highlight some of the concerns that have come up to date. The report lacks crucial data, information, and access. It represents a partial and incomplete picture. There was a joint statement, as I noted, that was put out. We also welcome a similar statement from the EU and EU members, sending a clear message the global community shares these concerns. There are steps from here that we believe should be taken. There's a second stage in this process that we believe should be led by international and independent experts. They should have unfettered access to data. They should be able to ask questions of people who are on the ground at this point in time, and that's a step the WHO could take.
And that statement says that the U.S. joins these countries in expressing shared concerns. But the statement, quite frankly, is pretty bureaucratic and perhaps does not meet the moment of the seriousness of the crisis here in this country in terms of the death toll. So what is the White House's actual reaction to this report from the WHO? Was it simply inadequate?
Well, the report is still being reviewed by our team of experts. 17 experts are reviewing it.
But you know the headline of it, and it's not sufficient.
We agree. And we have long said, as I just stated, it lacks crucial data, information, it lacks access, it lacks transparency. It certainly, we don't believe that in our review to date that it meets the moment, it meets the impact that this pandemic has had on the global community. And that's why we also have called for additional forward-looking steps.
And also at the White House today, President Biden signing an extension for the Paycheck Protection Program, known as PPP. It was created last year to help small businesses deal with the economic fallout from the pandemic. The deadline to apply for a PPP loan was extended from tomorrow to May 31st, and the law extends authorization of loans to June 30th to give the SBA, the Small Business Administration, additional time to process those applications. The president's remarks earlier today from the Oval Office.
Hello, everyone. How are you? I want to thank Administrator Guzman, who's run this show for us, and we're really starting to move here. And the Vice President, thank you.
Of course.
Your focus on small business, we're pushing lenders to raise their game and provide more help to the many small businesses, you know, particularly Hispanic as well as African-American small businesses are just out of business because they got bypassed the first time around. Today, I'm proud to sign the extension, which I'm going to do in a second, of the Paycheck Protection Program. It is a bipartisan accomplishment. Nearly 90,000 businesses are still in line, and there's money left. Without somebody signing this bill today, there are hundreds of thousands of people who could lose their jobs and small family businesses that might close forever. And as you know, small business is the backbone of our economy, representing almost 50% of all the employees in America. And I want to thank Senators Cardin, Shaheen, Rubio, and Collins for their work in the Senate, this bipartisan effort, and Young Kim and Velasquez, as well as Luke Meyer for their work in the House to make sure this happened. And the last 2 months, we've approved forgivable loans for 3,600 small businesses, 600,000 small businesses, and 3,300,000 of those small businesses were fewer than 20 employees, which is the backbone of most of the communities. So with that, I'm going to sign this, and thank you all for coming.
And with more on the president, there is this Wall Street Journal headline, quote, Biden underscores diversity with his first judicial nominees. With more on that story is Wall Street Journal White House reporter Ken Thomas. Walk us through the names and what stands out.
Well, it's an interesting list. President Biden is nominating 11 federal judges. And this is one of the earliest pushes that we've seen from a president in recent years. Most presidents typically only nominate a couple of judicial nominees in their first 100 days. I think there's a real focus on diversity from this group of initial nominees. He's nominating three black women to serve on the appeals court. He is going to be nominating someone who would be the first Muslim American federal judge. He's also nominating an Asian American Pacific Islander woman. And they also, the White House tried to make a point that it will be a diversity in professional background, that this will include a group who had worked as public defenders at law firms in the public interest sector and in the military. In terms of names, Steve, I think that the standout is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. She is the pick to succeed Merrick Garland on the Federal Appeals Court for the D.C. Circuit. That's a very high-profile position. And, you know, President Biden has made the pledge to choose a black woman for the Supreme Court once there's a vacancy. And you have to see Judge Jackson as someone who will be on the short list when that eventually happens, if that does happen during President Biden's term. She is someone who has served since 2013 on the district court. She also served as a law clerk to Stephen Breyer, Justice Breyer, who is now 82, and he is, you know, one of the potential retirements. We traditionally see those come around the end of the term in June.
And as you have read and certainly probably heard in recent months, there's been a push, maybe a discreet push, to Justice Breyer to perhaps step down.
Right. I think Democrats still look at the Obama years as perhaps, you know, a mistake, that they did not try to see if Ruth Bader Ginsburg might consider leaving early, and that then led to President Trump's ability to choose three Supreme Court picks, and that's why we have the current balance that we have. You know, I think that most Democrats, both inside and outside the White House, see Justice Breyer as someone who could step down. Like I said, it could, you know, probably as early as this June is when we might see that. You know, we don't know if he will step down, but the thinking is that if there's a time to get a Supreme Court pick and, you know, at the same time, these judicial nominations through the Senate, this is the time to act. Democrats have a 50-50 majority with Vice President Harris serving as the tie-breaking vote. And so if they are going to have an opportunity, you know, to get a Biden justice on the court, they're going to have to most likely do it before the midterms.
And so with these 10 federal judgeship selections, what's the next step? What's the path forward in the Senate? Any obstacles?
The path forward is, you know, the sort of difficult, labor-intensive process of, you know, going through the Senate Judiciary Committee, having these candidates, you know, having their records reviewed, having them meet with senators. And, you know, that's something that the Biden White House wanted to get going right away. They have been vetting these nominees since the start of the transition. And, you know, I think that what's unique here is that you have someone in President Biden who had served as the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So he's, you know, very well versed in everything that goes into getting a judicial nomination through the process. And his chief of staff, Ron Klain, was his chief counsel on the Judiciary Committee. And then during the Clinton White House, he was the associate White House counsel who oversaw judicial nominations. So you have two, you know, in the president and his chief of staff, you have, you know, two people who know, you know, very much the nuances of how these judicial nominations work, how much work is involved, and why you have to start early.
The story in today's Wall Street Journal and available tonight at WSJ.com. Ken Thomas, who covers the White House, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
And finally, it was on this date in 1981, just 2 months into his presidency, that Ronald Reagan was shot outside the Hilton Hotel on Connecticut Avenue after delivering remarks here in Washington, D.C. The initial report, this from CBS News.
This is a CBS News special report. From Washington, here is CBS News correspondent Richard Roth.
Good day. As we reported a bit earlier, President Reagan, shots were fired at President Reagan this afternoon within the past 20, 25 minutes or so as he left a speaking engagement at a Washington hotel. By all accounts, the president was not hurt. We have received videotape from the hotel where the president was emerging. You are watching it for the first time, as I am. There you saw what happened, the crowd calling to the president as he emerged from the Washington Hilton Hotel. The sound of gunfire. According to some eyewitnesses there were 3 to 5 shots. And some people fell, but the president, as you saw, was immediately hustled into his limousine, which our camera does not show at the moment. It immediately sped away. We are told that some people in the area were injured, and that seems clear from these pictures which we have just received. But again, we are told that the president himself was not hurt.
But of course, we later learned that afternoon that the president was injured and hospitalized. That from March 30th, 1981. It was 40 years ago today, the attempt on President Ronald Reagan's life by gunman John Hinckley at the Washington Hilton Hotel. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to sign up so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.